I started murdering people, there'd be none of you left.
Disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find out more about us and our work at www.deadsoulspodcast.com or over on Instagram by searching our name. As always, thank you for joining us. This is the story of two friends, an allegory for the consequences of your desires. And an age-old parable that if you court the devil, then the devil will pay his dues. This is a brief introduction recorded in October 2023. I wrote this episode back in 2017 as a video production for the YouTube platform. For various reasons, that video didn't get produced at the time, and I shelved the project. Now, 6 years later, and the murder of Tupac Shakur is back in the news following the arrest of Dwayne Keefe D. Davis. Davis, on Friday, September the 29th, 2023, has been formally charged with Tupac Shakur's murder. In 2019, Davis self-published his autobiography titled Compton Street Legend. Information that Davis wrote within that biography may work against him when his case eventually comes to trial, but we'll come to that in more detail later. Some of this episode may seem like it's delivered from a visual platform due to its original creation as a video documentary. Additionally, some aspects of the episode may reference things that I'm supposedly showing you in the video. Where this occurs, the items I'm discussing can be seen on our website, deadsoulspodcast.com/murder. Due to the huge volume of information to unpack, I have also chosen to deliver this episode in two parts. This is America's Most Wanted, The Killing of Biggie and Tupac, Part 1. I'm writing this while sat outside the world-famous Johnny's Coffee Shop at the intersection of Wilshire Boulevard and Fairfax Avenue in Los Angeles. As you can see, opposite me is the Saban Building, which when completed will be the home of the Academy Museum of Motion Pictures. And if you look across the junction diagonally there, you'll see a pretty interesting structure. It's a large silver and red mangle of metal and brickwork that is home to the Peterson Automotive Museum. I encourage you to Google this museum if you aren't familiar with it, to see just what I mean when I say the building is a strange mangle of metal. The main reason I'm standing here at this junction is not because of the history contained in the buildings here, but because of the history of what happened at these specific traffic lights. I am standing in the spot where, on March 9, 1997, Christopher Wallace, aka Biggie Smalls, was shot and killed right here in a drive-by shooting after leaving the Soul Train Awards after-party in the Peterson Automotive Museum just there. While Smalls' entourage were able to drive to nearby Cedars-Sinai Medical Center immediately after the shooting happened, Smalls was pronounced dead on arrival. The murder is significant in itself. But to further add mystery to the killing, it came just 6 months after the drive-by murder of rapper Tupac Shakur in Las Vegas. Rumors spread right away that the two deaths were related, and in this video, we are going to evidence just how related the murders actually were. But before we discuss those details, and the details surrounding the murders, those involved, and the motives for the deaths, we have to go back, right back, to the very beginning. Tupac Shakur was born on June 16, 1971 in East Harlem, New York. He was born LaSane Parrish Crooks, but at the age of just one, he was renamed Tupac Amaru Shakur by his mother, Afeni Shakur. Afeni was a former gang member and Black Panther activist. It was while she was in the Black Panthers that she met and married Lumumba Shakur in November 1968. That marriage fell apart in 1971 after the birth of Tupac, when Lumumba discovered that he was not the actual father of Tupac. His biological father was another Black Panther member by the name of Billy Garland. Garland, however, did not remain in Tupac's life growing up. In fact, Afeni would tell Tupac for many years that his real father was dead. It wasn't until much later that Tupac learned of the existence of Garland and they developed a paternal relationship. As a kid, Tupac and his mother moved around quite a lot, living in the San Francisco Bay Area, New York, Philadelphia, and eventually Baltimore, where he attended the Baltimore School for the Arts. Yep, Tupac was a theater kid. He certainly wasn't a violent gang member or street hustler. Even though Afeni was addicted to crack cocaine in Tupac's youth, he was brought up well-mannered with an interest in acting, poetry, and performing. Christopher George LaTorre Wallace, known also by his stage names as the Notorious B.I.G., Biggie Smalls, or just Biggie, was born at St. Mary's Hospital in Brooklyn, New York on May the 21st, 1972. He was the only child of parents Violetta Wallace, a preschool teacher, and Selwyn LaTorre Wallace, a welder and politician. His parents were Jamaican immigrants who came to the United States in the late 1960s. Biggie's father left the family when he was just 2 years old, and his mother worked two jobs while raising him as a single mother in Brooklyn's poor Bedford-Stuyvesant neighborhood. Violetta was a practicing Catholic, and Biggie was raised as one too. He was intelligent and performed well at Queen of All Saints Middle School, winning several English awards, before attending George Westinghouse Career and Technical Education High School, where Busta Rhymes and Jay-Z were his classmates. Biggie was given the nickname Big by friends who attended St. Peter Claver Church with him. He got the name due to being overweight for the age of just 10 years old. According to Biggie, he began dealing drugs at the age of 12 to earn extra money to support his mother. In actual fact, this was all just lore, a story that he would spin to create a hardened image of himself. He claimed that he dealt crack cocaine outside the Respect for Life barber salon on Fulton Street. In actual fact, he earned his money as a bag boy in the Met Food supermarket, which was across the road from the barbershop. Biggie would charge his school friends to come over and play his extensive range of video games at the time. You see, lore, image, and the pretense of being someone that they weren't is a big part of this story. In fact, some would argue that the needless deaths of Biggie and Tupac were all because they played the roles of people that they weren't, and those roles, sadly, overcame them. It consumed them. Sure, in his late teens, Biggie sold a bit of dope, although not enough to be considered a drug dealer. His music was more important to him. Tupac didn't have a criminal background at all. Before he started rapping, he was a roadie and backing dancer for the rap group Digital Underground. Friends described Tupac, at this time, as a soft-spoken, kind, generous, and a sweetheart. This is all the way back in the late 1980s. By 1997, however, both Tupac and Biggie were arguably two of the biggest names in hip-hop and gangster rap. They had both sold millions upon millions of albums and had contributed to the transformation of hip-hop and its sound in a significant way in such a short period of time. For those of you too young to remember, the early to mid-1990s were partly defined in popular culture by the East Coast-West Coast gangster rap rivalry. Biggie was East Coast, and Tupac was West Coast, but gangster rap was new. Before we get into the coastal rivalries, let's talk about gangster rap itself. The record label that first brought gangster rap to the world was Ruthless Records. Ruthless was started by Eric Wright, known more famously, of course, as Eazy-E, and his business partner, music manager, Jerry Heller, in 1987. It was the label that released Eazy-E's band NWA's studio albums. Now, NWA, for those unaware, were notorious in the early 90s for being the rap group which triggered the American moral panic in regards to rap music. I won't state here what NWA stands for, but it's a Google click away. Law enforcement, conservative and family advocacy groups, and even governmental spokespeople actively spoke out about the dangers of rap's influence on the youth of America. Gangster rap became politicized. It emerged during the time of the war on drugs, the 1993 US crime bill, the 90s super predator myth, the crack epidemic, the three strikes and you're out law changes, and 24-hour rolling news. To white teenage middle-class America, this all seemed like a movie. Advocacy groups were concerned that gangster rap was promoting violence against law enforcement. It promoted drugs, a criminal lifestyle, and glorifying gangster culture. All these things that were at the height of every news story at the time. In response, gangster rappers argued that they rapped about what they lived and their experience of life on the streets. That they were finally given a platform to speak out, that their struggles were now in the public eye. All of this was partly true for Eazy-E, for example, because prior to joining NWA, he was a known drug dealer. Although I will state that various sources, such as Jerry Heller, would later say that his drug dealing was merely a form of armor to keep a guarded reputation in the LA neighborhood of Compton, where gang culture and crime rates were very high, and from where Eazy-E came from. That aside, his life experience was the harsh reality of a criminal lifestyle, and that's what he would rap about. I'll drop a fun fact in at this stage. Did you know that before Dr. Dre joined NWA, he was a member of rap group World Class Wrecking Crew? In that group, that played electro-funk rap, Dre would regularly take to the stage wearing eyeliner and a sequined, form-fitting, cream-colored jumpsuit, complete with a stethoscope. Not exactly a badass gangster. Anyway, the notoriety given to NWA, and in particular Eazy-E's drug dealing background, gave rap a newfound edginess and image of criminality that it didn't have before. Before gangster rap became a thing in the early 90s, rap had a kind of goofy and pop-friendly image to it. Electro rap was popular, as was acts like Run-DMC, Salt-N-Pepa, MC Hammer, and Grandmaster Flash. It has its audience, but it wasn't the financial and cultural monolith it later became to be. In actual fact, the main audience for gangster rap was white teenage boys. They coveted the lifestyle that they saw as far away, and they saw it on things like CNN, and the image that it portrayed not only appealed to them, but it sold by the millions. Thus, what followed NWA and those early gangster rap pioneers were keen to cash in on that image and sound. Q, Bad Boy Records, run by Sean Combs, aka Puff Daddy, Puffy, or P. Diddy, and also Death Row Records, run by hip-hop's greatest villain, Marion Knight, also known as Suge Knight. Both Puffy and Suge were hugely influenced by the gangster rap image and sound, and that's what they promoted. Now, Marion Suge Knight, so named because his childhood nickname was Sugar Bear, was born in 1965, and he also grew up in the Compton area of Los Angeles. Knight, even though many of his friends were gang members while growing up, wasn't involved in any gang activity. He focused on his athletic career and was a star defensive end. From 1983 to 1985, he attended and played football at El Camino College in Alondra Park, California. He transferred to the University of Nevada, Las Vegas in 1985 and played football there for 2 years. He also played two games for the LA Rams during the 1986 NFL players' strike, essentially playing as a scab. His NFL career was short-lived, however, when he skipped the Rams' training camp in order to go and stalk his ex-girlfriend. This will also paint an early picture of what kind of guy Suge would become. Following his brief stint at the LA Rams, he began promoting music acts and concerts in Southern California, and also worked as the bodyguard for Bobby Brown between 1988 and 1989. Make no mistake, Suge Knight is huge, built like a refrigerator, by all accounts, standing at 6'2" tall and pushing almost 300 pounds. In 1989, Suge began his own music publishing company, with his first client being Mario Johnson, aka Chocolate. Chocolate worked out of Texas and was the person who actually wrote Ice Ice Baby, which was later performed by Rob Van Winkle, aka Vanilla Ice. Now, Suge had learned early on in life that he could use his size and strength to his advantage, and this situation was no different. Chocolate had told Suge that he had written Ice Ice Baby and provided Suge with written evidence. Vanilla Ice, he said, was claiming all the royalties. However, as he claimed that he had written the song when he was 16, he was owed them. Bear in mind now that Vanilla Ice had already borrowed the song's bass line from the band Queen, so his claims weren't necessarily credible. What followed, so the story goes, is that Suge Knight, along with a couple of his heavy-set associates, broke down the door of Vanilla Ice's hotel room and took him out to the balcony on the 15th floor, dangling him over the edge by his ankles until Vanilla Ice signed over the royalties to Chocolate. This pocketed Chocolate around $4 million, and Suge's reputation as a tough businessman who could get anything done spread pretty quickly. Around this time, Suge also got involved with Ruthless Records. You remember Eazy-E's label? Well, Suge had signed up rap artist The D.O.C. to his publishing company at the same time as Chocolate. Following this, he soon managed to get The D.O.C. signed by Ruthless Records, and pretty quickly, Suge found himself firmly embedded in Ruthless Records. Thus, Suge found himself learning a lot about the music industry and the running of a record label. Suge began to notice that the relationship between Eazy-E and his N.W.A. bandmate Dr. Dre was beginning to sour, and he seized this opportunity. He offered to sign Dr. Dre as an independent artist on his new record label, Death Row Records. After all, Suge knew he needed a big star to give his label legitimacy, not to mention provide it with an income. There was a problem, though. Dre was still under contract to Ruthless Records. So Suge hatched a plan. He arranged for Dre to organize a meeting between him and Eazy-E at a recording studio called Galaxy Sounds. Eazy agreed, but when he showed up at the studio, Dre was nowhere to be seen. It was Suge and three of his heavy-set associates that were at the studio waiting with lead pipes. So in a soundproof recording booth, Suge invited Eazy-E to sit down. Initially, it said, Suge gave Eazy-E the option to simply release Dre from his contract. When Eazy refused, Suge showed Eazy a slip of paper with his mother's address written on it, along with a picture of her house. Eazy-E immediately gave in and released Dre from his contract. So that was it. Death Row Records was born and had a roster of talent. They also would soon discover a 19-year-old kid named Calvin Brodus, aka Snoop Doggy Dogg, as he was known at the time. In a very short period of time, Death Row Records released Dr. Dre's The Chronic and Snoop Doggy's Doggy Style, both becoming two of the biggest hip-hop albums of all time. Now, let's talk Bad Boy Records over in New York City, on the East Coast. Born Sean John Combs, he would soon become more well-known as his stage name Puff Daddy, Puffy, P. Diddy, or just Diddy. Puffy was born in Harlem, New York on the 4th of November 1969. His mother, Janice Combs, was a model and teacher's assistant, and his father, Melvin Earl Combs, served in the U.S. Air Force and was an associate of convicted New York drug dealer Frank Lucas. Melvin was shot to death at age 33, and when Sean was just 2 years old. Combs graduated from Mount St. Michael Academy in 1987. Combs was given the nickname Puff because he would huff and puff when he was angry. Puffy avoided any criminal involvement in his early years due to what happened in part to his father. He also had a comfortable upbringing, so didn't need to run with the wrong crowd. That said, those that know Puffy claim he's quite a complicated character. Puffy enrolled as a business major at Howard University in Washington, D.C., but he would drop out after his sophomore year. In 1990, Puffy secured a role as an intern at Uptown Records. This gave him a foot in the door and experience within the music industry. He also built relationships with several big rap and R&B artists of the day. Puffy was always a music guy, for lack of a better phrase. He worked as a backup dancer for Heavy D and the Boys in the late 80s after his graduation from Mount St. Michael's. He was also a natural manager and organizer, showing strong business acumen from a young age. But Puffy got fired from Uptown in 1991 after promoting an AIDS fundraiser that got extremely oversold. A stampede at the event saw the deaths of 9 people who were in attendance. After Uptown, Puffy set up Bad Boy Records and immediately signed up a new young artist named Christopher Wallace. Puffy had been trying to push Wallace on Uptown Records, but his image and sound wasn't what Uptown was about. So Puffy knew he had to do it himself. So thanks to Suge Knight, Ruthless Records had lost its biggest artists and its industry influence. This made way for the only two labels who were releasing gangster rap at the time, Death Row Records and Bad Boy Records. These two labels alone would influence and guide what is now considered the golden age of hip-hop. In 1994 alone, what are now considered classic and significantly influential albums were dropped from Nas, Outkast, Warren G, Redman, Method Man, Spice One, The Beastie Boys, Ready to Die, by the Notorious B.I.G. and Gravediggers, not forgetting groundbreaking albums like we've previously mentioned, The Chronic by Dr. Dre and Doggy Style by Snoop Doggy Dogg, just 12 months prior. No one could deny that the scene and genre was on fire, and all of these artists, the one that was arguably getting the most respect and the most attention, was Tupac. He had released 2 albums by the beginning of 1994. He'd appeared in several movies such as Nothing But Trouble, Juice, Poetic Justice, and Above the Rim. He was a household name, and in 1994 alone, Tupac earned $80 million in record sales alone. In 1993, while visiting Los Angeles, Biggie Smalls requested an introduction to Tupac Shakur via a local drug dealer friend that they had in common. Tupac invited Biggie over to his house, where they played with unloaded machine guns and handguns, and Tupac cooked steaks in the kitchen for them both. Smalls and Shakur became fast and close friends. Biggie had wanted to meet Shakur for a while and was a big fan of his music. The pair would socialize when Shakur went to New York or when Smalls was in Los Angeles. At his live shows, Shakur would often call Biggie onto the stage to rap with him. Shakur affectionately called Biggie Christopher, something only Tupac and Smalls' own mother were allowed to do. Biggie called Tupac Duke. Together, they recorded the songs Running from the Police and House of Pain. Biggie actually asked Shakur to manage him, but knowing he was no businessman, Shakur's advice to Smalls was to work with Sean Puffy Combs, who would make him a star. Shakur invited Smalls to join his side group, Thug Life, in 1994, but Smalls politely declined in order to create his own side group, the Junior Mafia. There was no doubt about it, however, Shakur and Smalls were close and very fond friends. Something to remind you here and to keep in mind regarding Tupac: he was a theater kid. Well, he never really got out of that mindset, and he would love to play gangster, carry guns, and impersonate various movie character criminals like Scarface and Don Corleone. Close friends commented that after Tupac starred in the 1992 movie Juice, he became obsessed for a while with becoming the character of Bishop that he played in the movie. Bishop was the dark criminal antagonist of the picture, and not exactly the role model most would take from the story. Sadly, Tupac was falling deeper into the criminal psyche, blurring the lines between playing gangster and acting gangster and becoming gangster. In 1994, Tupac went to New York to shoot the basketball movie Above the Rim. In the movie, Tupac would play the role of Birdie, a drug dealer. In order to prepare and research for the role, Tupac reached out to infamous New York music promoter and all-around bag of human shit, Haitian Jack. Haitian Jack was a serious criminal. He dealt crack throughout the 1980s, robbed rival drug dealers and survived, was imprisoned for rape, and is on the suspect in a number of unsolved murder cases. Biggie had warned Tupac not to get involved with Haitian Jack, and gave him the lowdown on his reputation and rap sheet. But Tupac didn't listen to Biggie or anyone else who had warned him about Haitian Jack for that matter. In fact, not long after Tupac met Haitian Jack, Tupac would be charged with committing the worst crime of his life. In October of 1993, Ayanna Jackson accused Tupac, Haitian Jack, and several other members of Tupac's entourage of gang raping her and sodomizing her in a hotel room on the 38th floor of the Parker Meridian Hotel where Tupac was staying. Jackson, who was just 19 at the time, was approached by Tupac at Nell's nightclub on West 14th Street in New York, and he invited her to dance with him. She willingly performed oral sex on Tupac on the dance floor, which led to them both going back to his hotel that night. Jackson and Shakur went out a few more times over the next few weeks, which culminated in her visiting Tupac at his hotel on the fourth date, where she claims she was gang raped by Tupac and his entourage. Tupac denied being involved, although he did later admit to being in the next room at the time of the rape and blamed himself for not doing anything to stop it happening. A New York jury took no leniency, however, and found him culpable, sentencing him to 1.5 to 4.5 years in prison. But in the interval between the crime and the sentencing, events would transpire that would be the catalyst to the now infamous East Coast-West Coast rap war. Tupac was facing full rape charges, but Haitian Jack, who was also very much involved in the rape, was able to plead out on 2 misdemeanor charges. So, to Tupac, this meant that Haitian Jack had to have been a snitch and was trying to set him up. Tupac being Tupac didn't just keep this feeling to himself either. No, no. He told any reporter who would listen at the time. His feelings were splashed across the pages of the Daily News, and certainly no secret. But calling out a man like Haitian Jack was not a good idea, let alone in such a public way. Tupac, though, was high on his own fame and ego. He actually thought he was invincible and an actual gangster. He believed his own hype. He couldn't have been further from the truth. Through the press, he called Haitian Jack a hanger-on. From prison, boxer Mike Tyson called Shakur and warned him that he was out of his league hanging with Haitian Jack and to be very careful. Biggie Smalls also warned Tupac again that he was caught in trouble by disrespecting Haitian Jack. At this point in early 1994, Tupac had also briefly taken up with Madonna, who was attracted to Tupac's gangster image. But that relationship quickly fizzled out after the pop star discovered that Tupac Shakur's image wasn't real and it didn't match his reality. Haitian Jack was about to show Tupac just how far he had stepped out of line. The location of that lesson was Quad Recording Studios in Times Square, a location where Biggie and Puffy just happened to be recording at the same time and on the same day that Tupac would be there, although working on a different floor. Tupac showed up to the recording studio to record a guest verse for an artist named Little Sean. Just before he was about to get into the elevator, he was approached by 3 guys wearing army fatigues. Tupac assumed these guys were with Biggie, as that was the Brooklyn style at the time and what Biggie's entourage were wearing. Just as the elevator doors opened, the guys pulled out handguns. Tupac reacted quickly and reached for his gun, but in trying to pull it out of his waistband, he accidentally pulled the trigger and shot himself instead. After Tupac shot himself, the guys took advantage of the situation and assaulted and beat Tupac, stealing his jewelry and leaving him for dead. Tupac would go on to tell everyone that he got shot 5 times. This wasn't true. His medical records, which are now public, and also confirmation from Billy Garland, his father who visited him in hospital, both state that he was not shot 5 times, but just the once by himself. All other wounds he sustained were from the beating he received from the 3 guys who attacked him. While Tupac was in hospital, a rumor went around that Tupac had been shot in the penis. But this too wasn't true. Garland also confirmed this when he jokingly told documentarian Nick Broomfield that Tupac had showed him for good measure. Following the attack, Tupac stumbled into the elevator and took the elevator upstairs. When the doors opened, Biggie, Puffy, and a friend of Haitian Jack named Jimmy Hinchman Rosemond were all standing there. Tupac later said that when those elevator doors opened and he looked in Biggie and Puffy's eyes, he saw the guilt that they felt in ordering his attack. However, in 2011, a guy named Dexter Isaac admitted to being one of the three guys who attacked Tupac. He said the attack was on the orders of Hinchman Rosemond and on behalf of Haitian Jack. Isaac also confirmed that the attack had absolutely nothing to do with Biggie or Puffy. Further, they had no knowledge that it was going to occur either, and if they did, they almost certainly would have warned or tried to protect Tupac, given Biggie's friendship and his reluctance to get involved with Haitian Jack. The situation is all so sad when you think about how it would develop. Hinchman Rosemond was at the Quad Studios as he was the manager of Little Sean, the artist that Tupac was collaborating with that day. Tupac, however, could not accept the truth and only saw it one way. He saw it that Biggie had ordered him to be killed. Tupac had become so egomaniacal that everything had to be about him and how everyone was jealous of him and wanted to be him and have his career and talent. Tupac actually turned on his own friends and allies. Things escalated further for Tupac when he went to prison shortly after the assault happened, and due to his rape charge. Allegedly, other inmates were telling Tupac that their associates out on the streets had confirmed to them that Biggie and Puffy were behind his attack. Tupac was cut off from everyone while in jail. His paranoia got the better of him, and he believed what people were telling him. After all, it's what he had been thinking of himself anyway. They just confirmed it for him. On February the 21st, 1995, Biggie released a song called Who Shot Ya? It contained the following lyrics.
Who shot ya? Separate the weak from the obsolete. Hard to creep them Brooklyn streets. You rewind this. Bad boys behind this.
Tupac immediately assumed that this was a diss track about him and an admission of guilt from Biggie and Puffy. What Tupac chose to ignore, or didn't realize, was that Who Shot Ya was recorded months before Tupac was even attacked. The song had nothing to do with him. Yet Biggie released it, but it was originally written for Mary J. Blige. Chucky Thompson and Nasheem Myrick produced the track along with Puffy, although Puffy didn't have any creative input. Biggie originally only had one verse alongside LL Cool J, but after it was deemed too hardcore for Mary J. Blige, it became a Biggie track. Tupac sat in prison and seethed about the attack and what he thought was a diss track humiliating him further. He spent a lot of time writing letters to Jim Carrey and Tony Danza from his cell. Strangely, celebrity friends of Tupac at the time. Tupac needed to get out of jail, but he needed help. His bail was set at $3 million. And even though he had a huge musical and acting career, Tupac didn't have anywhere near that kind of cash available. Firstly, music royalties and movie payments take a minimum of 18 months to reach the artist. Additionally, Tupac had a lot of legal troubles throughout his career. With those legal troubles came a lot of hefty legal bills to pay. But there was one man who did have that kind of money available. Q. Suge Knight. According to Original Gangsters by author Ben Westhoff, Tupac wrote to Suge Knight from prison and asked him for help. In this, Suge saw a fantastic opportunity. He knew he already had the best producer in hip-hop with Dr. Dre. So if he could add the best rapper to his catalog, he felt that he would be number one, that Death Row Records would be the undisputed top hip-hop record label in the United States. So negotiations immediately began for Tupac to move from Interscope Records to Death Row. The deal wasn't difficult as Death Row was under the Interscope umbrella at the time. This just greased the wheels. So the deal was, in exchange for Death Row legal services and the bond, Tupac would appoint Suge Knight as his manager and would sign to Death Row Records for 3 albums. Whilst it doesn't seem like much on paper, Tupac essentially signed his life away to Suge Knight completely. because Suge Knight is now both his manager and his label rep, so Tupac has no independent advisor or business-related safety net. Suge is also the one who bailed him out of prison, so Tupac faces indentured servitude. Tupac didn't have much choice. There were rumors circulating that his gangster image had been found out to be fake in prison. There were further rumors that Tupac faced daily rape while incarcerated. Tupac was desperate. So, less than a month after Tupac had agreed to this deal with Suge, the $1.4 million bond was paid and Tupac was released. Great. But the $1.4 million bond wasn't actually paid by Death Row Records. It turned out to be an advance on future royalties, which only bonded Tupac to Suge even closer. Yeah, always read the small print. Death Row wasn't really paying Tupac. Tupac was paying himself from any future earnings. It was sort of like a loan. Anyway, Tupac was a free man again, and the first thing he did was be sure to tell Suge all about the supposed plot on his life by Biggie and Puffy. Suge bought into the story 100%. He bought into it and also saw a hell of a business opportunity. On an individual basis, Suge and Tupac were both volatile people, but neither were explosive. But when they became tied together, it was like setting a match to gasoline. In the process, many, many people would be burned alive as a result. The catalyst had started, and the countdown which led to the disasters of 1996 and 97 respectively had already begun. Coming up in episode 2, we'll go into the events that led directly to the deaths of both Christopher Wallace and Tupac Shakur. We'll also reveal the names of all those involved and who pulled the triggers on both occasions. Stick with us for part 2 of America's Most Wanted, the killing of Biggie and Tupac.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.